Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, brought by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back one of our great guest co-hosts, Dr. Bob Gwaither. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
How you been doing?
I've been doing all right.
Good. You always seem relaxed. Is that what semi-retirement is?
Yes. This is full retirement, actually, but I'm still back playing games with my friends.
Well, we do appreciate that. On our show today, we're going to have a great guest, Dr. Perry Klass, author and professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, to talk about her work influencing both science and art. Really looking forward to that conversation.
It ought to be good. She's a very distinguished professor.
First, though, let's talk about some research that matters. Let's dive right in. The first one's about exercise and preventing early death, daily exercise. Are you exercising in your semi, now full-time retirement?
Almost every day.
And what type of exercise do you like?
I alternate resistance training and elliptical trainer for aerobics.
Well, we know then that you probably are doing great, because those who exercise 5 days a week for 30 minutes in this study reduced their risk of dying and developing heart disease, looking at over 130,000 people from 17 countries. What did they find?
They found that if you exercised about 30 minutes a day, you'd drop your cardiovascular chance of dying about 1 in 12.
Yeah, that's pretty profound. That's as far as kind of health impacts go in medicine, that's a big one.
That really is. And there's some good things about it, because it doesn't cost anything. If you compare it to other kinds of things like medications, of course, both could be involved with any one person anyway.
Yeah, this was actually published in The Lancet, which is one of the more prestigious medical journals. And they also found that there was really no ceiling effect. Like, we've seen some other research that suggests that, well, once you get above, let's say, 15, 20 minutes a day, you don't get much benefit. They actually said that they really found even very high benefits, more so for those who were exercising, you know, every day than for those who were only exercising 3 or 4 times a week.
Up to 41 hours a week. So there was no bad from doing it, and there was a good correlation for further increase in benefits the more exercise you did.
I think I got to retire tomorrow, Bob, just because I got to be able to take advantage of this benefit.
We need to talk.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters. You know, we take drugs when we have chronic medical problems. We are prescribed drugs by our physicians. But the question is, when new drugs come out, are they as safe as we maybe think they are? And what happens if the pharmaceutical companies are required to do additional safety studies, even though the drug may be out? What happens?
Well, it happens quite often that they want to get this approved before they can get them done. And they understand that's a problem, so they usually assign the pharmaceutical company a mandate to do some kind of testing to prove that its dose is efficacious and that there aren't unexpected consequences.
And in this particular commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine, a researcher from Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy looked at federal records and looked among 614 studies that were mandated in 2009 and 2010. These are kind of additional safety studies after these drugs that we might be prescribing have already hit the market. And they said 20% of these safety studies were never started and 9% had been delayed. I found that kind of shocking.
It is kind of shocking to me, too. And they also found that some of the ones that they assigned, they'd extended a couple times, and then they just dropped the requirement because it had to get done. And Dr. Wulshin of the Dartmouth Institute really was pushing for information about which ones hadn't been done. And there was a lot of pushback from the pharmaceutical companies, some of whom said, oh, yeah, we did it, and here's the proof, which probably meant that they didn't do their record keeping very well.
Or that maybe that could there have been more side effects and that wasn't publicized. It certainly gives you cause for concern. You know, some of the ones that the deadlines perhaps were being missed were on Suboxone, a drug that's used to treat opioid dependence, and multiple sclerosis treatment called Gilenya, other Victoza diabetes drug. These doesn't mean these drugs aren't safe, but it suggests that if the FDA asked these companies that they needed to do more studies to assure the safety, that perhaps if you're taking one of these drugs, you should look on and see, has that study been done, and maybe press them to finish these studies.
Amen.
Well, let's move on to our next research that matters, and we're going from the clinic to policy. And the policy we're looking at is the impact of what would be called dirty air, and this specific aspect, breathing dirty air, which we can imagine is really bad for our lungs, and it is, but is it also bad for our kidneys?
And nobody had thought to really study that. And what they figured out is that the kidney is a filter mechanism in part, just like the lungs are a filter mechanism in part. And they had, at Washington University, access to a lot of VA records. And so they studied 2.5 million VA people over 8.5 years beginning in 2004 and found out that, voila, the particulate matter in dirty air can harm the kidneys by being filtered into the kidney from the blood and then harming the kidney because of blockage of parts of the kidney.
And this was published in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology, and they actually suggest that, kind of extrapolating from this data, that there are over 40,000 new cases of kidney disease and almost 2,500 new cases of kidney failure that could be attributed to levels of air pollution. That would make me stand up and take notice, particularly if you're in areas where you're more likely to be exposed to air pollution, like increased smog in certain areas, maybe in California, or if you're in areas of energy producing like coal, where, again, you could be exposed to dirtier air.
Right. Well, of course, these veterans are located all over the country. They also did two things that they thought were kind of cool. One of them was the EPA tends to monitor the air pollution from the ground, and there's a NASA mandate to do the same thing from satellites up in the air, and they did them in their different technologies or different formulas, but they had very close agreement that this actually occurs.
Let's go to our very last research that matters, Bob. And it's really something that I think our listeners have all heard of. We've certainly heard of, followed. And it's the problem with the dirty water in Flint. And we know that that's the lead in that water and the impact on children in that community has to be pervasive. And it's incredibly difficult and sad. This just adds to that story. And it looks at what we would call declines in fertility or increase in fetal deaths as a result of this exposure.
Yeah, well, and we knew for years what lead did to children who were already alive or who had manifestations of it from infancy because they got it at the end. But nobody knew what the effect on fertility was. In other words, did these women have miscarriages or fetal death at a greater pace than other people, and actually between 198 and 276 more children would have been living in Flint today had it not been for the pollution events that happened while their mothers were pregnant with them.
Yeah, and this is not necessarily, you can't say this was a case control cohort. This is not a randomized controlled trial, so we can't say for certain, but they did find that these increased fetal death rates had not occurred in other communities across the region in Michigan. They think that even that this might have been underreported because they don't include abortions, they don't include early miscarriages, and they were restricted to hospitals that reported these events. And this would be a 58% increase in fetal deaths. I think there's a huge lesson here. There's a huge reparation that needs to be done. And those who are responsible certainly should be held accountable.
The other thing that it didn't look like any of the Michigan communities, but it did look like Washington, D.C. from 2000 to 2003, when lead intoxication in the water was also present in about the same quantities that it was in Flint.
Well, we've ended up in an area where we know it's difficult. We started in an area where we can do something really positive on our health in terms of really increasing our physical activity. And when we come back, we're going to hear about some other positive things we can do on our health when we interview our guest, Dr. Perry Klass, to talk about how her work influences both science and art. She's an author and professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Perry Klass, author and professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, about how her work has influenced both the science and art of medicine. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Klass.
Thank you so much.
You know, I think it's interesting to us when we have someone who is an author and a professor of both journalism and pediatrics. I think we want to know, how did you get interest in both fields? Where did that come from?
Well, I grew up in a writing family. My mother taught writing. Both my parents cared a lot about writing. I have a writing uncle, a writing aunt, writing siblings. But I didn't think of that as the way that you earned your living. I thought of that as something that you did because it gave so much pleasure and added so much to your life. And I went to college and studied biology and went to medical school and planned to be a doctor and, you know, did my residency to become a pediatrician. But along the way in medical school, as I was writing short stories, I was also offered the opportunity to write about my training. And what I realized is that writing from the inside, telling some of the stories, since medicine is such a profession of stories, and the privilege of learning clinical medicine is so much about being allowed access into stories of other people, that writing from the inside allowed me to tell all kinds of stories, and I kind of almost backed into being a journalist, first by writing about myself in this world, and then by learning how to ask the questions and write the stories that took me other places in the medical world.
Your passion for books really extends beyond writing. Tell us about Reach Out and Read.
Reach Out and Read is a national program to promote parents looking at books, reading aloud, talking about books with very young children. We're talking infants, toddlers, preschoolers, and we do that through the connection that we make in the pediatric office at the pediatric well child visit, the primary care visit, the checkup. Because, you know, as pediatricians, we have this chance to see children starting when they're born, to talk to parents starting when their children are very, very young about what they can do, what's in their power as parents in terms of back and forth, interactions, language, opening up the whole rich, unbelievable world to their children. And, of course, it's what all parents want to do. So Reach Out and Read is a model that takes advantage of those connections in the pediatric checkup, and we train pediatricians, nurse practitioners, all the family medicine doctors, everyone who's doing the primary care for young children to talk about the importance of reading aloud, looking at books with young children, and we give a beautiful new developmentally appropriate children's book at those checkups. And we try to help parents and support parents as they look for ways to build those books and stories and reading aloud and lap time and FaceTime into their children's lives from the very beginning.
And this is a national program, I gather.
Yep, we're reaching more than 4.5 million children every year in all 50 states. And we've got more than 20,000 pediatricians, family physicians, nurse practitioners who've done the training and are doing this every day in their offices.
You know, I find this really quite remarkable when I think back to my own visits to my pediatrician growing up. I think I was fearful of going to the pediatrician. I seemed like I would like to go to the dentist. And in part of that, I think, is because the dentist had great reading materials there that were, you know, child-centric. And yet here you're offering the opportunity of a child to perhaps want to go to see the doctor, much less the parent, and to have the physician acting in a role that I certainly never received in my training. How did this idea, you know, kind of generate? And did your own background, what was the formative aspect of being read to?
Well, I'll just say that for me, being read to was tremendously important. My parents read to us all the time, and my father in particular, who had certain theatrical, he was a professor and he liked to talk as professors do, but he also, he did a lot of community theater. He liked doing accents. He liked doing funny voices. And he read aloud to us, not just when I was young, but straight through elementary school and on into middle school. He read aloud, and there are enormous numbers of books and stories out there, which when I sit down to read them, I still hear my father's voice. But what you say about going to the doctor is very much to the point. We think that one of the reasons we've had such uptake from the medical providers is this does offer a way to bond with the children, bond with the parents. And, you know, I think in addition to the joy of bringing the book into the room and watching the child react and being able to say to the parent, what a smart 4-month-old, 6-month-old, 12-month-old, 2-year-old you've got there. Look how she can handle the book. Look how he knows just how to point to the pictures. There's also a sort of an unspoken message which parents really hear, in which the doctor is saying, I'm looking at your child and I see a future reader. I see someone who's going to develop and learn and grow. And when I look at you, the parents, I see the people who are going to make that happen in these early years, who are going to help and support your child. And that is, it's so true. It's true of almost all parents, but it's not something that we always remember to stop and recognize, because we have such a long list of warnings and good advice and whatever you do, don't do this, and this is safe and this is not safe, that I think it's a good way for us to connect with parents around what we all know, which is that this is a partnership about helping the child develop and grow and really reach full brain power, full potential. And when you think back to the way that many of us grew up, I think that what we're remembering is that shift in pediatrics, which happens especially with immunizations and with the drop-off in some of the diseases which used to be such a problem and which used to worry the pediatricians and the parents so much, that we've now moved into an era where we want to prevent disease, of course, but we also, when we ask parents what they want to know from us, they want to talk about development. They want to know about normal development. They want to know what they can do to help their children thrive. They worry about issues like whether children can learn from screens, and we know that young children cannot learn language from screens. And that's what they want us to talk about. And in addition to encouraging reading aloud and early literacy, bringing the book into the exam room, I think gives medical providers, gives pediatricians a chance to open up all of those other subjects.
Yeah, and as family physicians, I'm sure this is true for pediatrics as well. We try to teach the resident that it's the stories that matter and it's that that connects it. And I think this reading and this book paradigm really tends to facilitate that.
And I'd also just like to say a word for the family physicians and what they've helped us learn as partners in Reach Out and Read is that, of course, the family physicians are often the ones who are most aware, since the parents may also be their patients, most aware of often the parents' own educational backgrounds, what some parents may have had to overcome when we're asking them to think in terms of reading and stories. And I think there's that whole family perspective that's really important here is how can we help parents do what they so want to do for their children? How can we also be mindful of the stories that they come with, just as you were saying?
You know, we're going to take a short break in just a second, but maybe you could just say a word. I know you have co-authored number of books. We want to talk about some of them when you come back, but one of them that reminded me as you were just talking was a book that you co-authored called Quirky Kids, Understanding and Helping Your Child Who Doesn't Fit In. This seems to be such a important part of being able to develop self-esteem, which Reach Out and Read has to be really trying to do.
Well, there's so many different ways that I think that the books and the reading contribute both to that issue of self-esteem, but also to the when I wrote Quirky Kids with a good friend who's another pediatrician, Eileen Costello, we were focusing less on the different diagnoses which many children who don't fit in may pick up or circle as they're growing up. And what we were really trying to focus on instead was kind of navigating the complexities of everyday life at home with children, especially children who aren't following the blueprint for how they're supposed to behave at any given age. So we were trying to focus on the question of getting out of the house in the morning. We were trying to focus on bedtime for children with a whole different variety of sleep issues. And one of the things that I love being able to do and reach out and read is look at the book and think about it as a prop or a prompt or a script for moments when you need to develop the routines that work for your child, even if that means a truck book at bedtime every night for years. But the routines which you can build, which actually help you navigate the day, but also help your child feel loved and secure and appreciated for being that particular child.
You must have been in our living room. We certainly needed you there. We need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Perry Klass, author and professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, about the influence that her work has had on both the science and art of medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we've been talking with Dr. Perry Klass, author and professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University, about how her work in journalism and medicine is really influencing children and parents and relationships.
We got to talk a little bit about some of your work, because a couple of things really struck me, too. The first one is this book, Treatment Kind and Fair, Letters to a Young Doctor, which you wrote to your son, actually, or about your son, as he was apparently contemplating going to medical school.
Well, this was a series. They had, you know, letters to a young mathematician, letters to a young journalist, and the idea was that you would write it in the form of letters. And when they asked me to write letters to a young doctor, I did, in fact, have a son who was applying to medical school, and I said, can I write it to a real young doctor, because I think it'll feel more real, and they let me do that. So then, of course, at some point in the middle of the night, I had a panic attack, and I called my son and I said, this is terrible. What if I write the book and then you decide that you don't want to go to medical school after all, and I'll have embarrassed you and I should never have done this? And my son said very patiently, do you really think that after putting in all the effort to take all the pre-med classes and do all the stuff that I had to invest, that the thing that will be on my mind if I decide not to go to medical school is, oh, too bad, now my mother wrote that book and it looks a little silly? So, but he did go to medical school, and it was a delight to be able to write to him both about some of my thoughts as someone who'd been in medicine for a while and as someone who saw smart young people choosing the field, but also to be able to acknowledge as I wrote to him that there was a lot he had seen growing up because he was the child of a doctor. And I'm sure you both could speak to that as well. Our children do get a sort of an interesting picture of what ties us to medicine, what frustrates us, what worries us on weekends, what trails after us when we come home from the clinic, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I think about my children. I have three children. I think you as well do. And none of them went into medicine. They're all in business. But the power of reading in books, and with my middle son, we've been reading some of Michael Lewis's books, Flash Boys and The Big Short, and get into conversations, maybe as you did with your son, about ethics and stories and some of the things that happened for which you just sometimes go, wow, the power of the book to stimulate relationships. Do you look upon all books and narrative as relationships?
What an interesting question. I certainly think that books take on extra meaning when they come into play between people and between teachers and students and within families. As you sort of said at the beginning, I teach journalism, and one of the joys of teaching journalism is I get to try to pick essays or reported pieces that I think are going to really rock students' worlds. And when you find that piece, when somebody comes in the next week saying, I never imagined that essay was out there. I never dreamed that somebody 100 years ago would have been thinking that way or writing that way. You know, that's a tremendous statement about the power of the written word and the way that it can reach across all kinds of boundaries.
You actually co-wrote one of your books about your mother. What's the story behind Every Mother is a Daughter?
Well, my mother was a writer, and she cared passionately about being a writer, and she taught writing in college for her entire professional career for decades and decades. And she believed this, I don't know what the word is, zealously, messianically. My mother believed that you have a story to tell that nobody else can tell, and you have a voice to tell it in, and that if you don't give yourself a chance to tell that story and find that voice, then you're sort of cutting yourself off from some of the greatest joy that you can find in life. What I try to say is I think my mother felt about it the way if you were growing up in a very musical family and the parents looked at the child and they didn't necessarily think, oh, this child will be a professional musician, but of course music is what they loved most in the world. Of course, looking at the child whom they loved so dearly, they would want the child to know the joy and the passion and the power of music. I think that's how my mother felt about the written word. So we wrote a book together eventually. We called it A Memoir in Two Voices, going back and forth, in which I would sort of say, well, Mom, now it's time to tell me what you thought when I told you I was having a baby in my second year of medical school. What did you and Pop really say to each other when I wasn't there? And she would answer. And then we had a lot of fun doing it, and it was really interesting. And, of course, the voices are so very different on the page.
Yeah, fascinating. I think when one thinks about the conversations between parents and children, my parents, when they didn't want me to hear something, they would just start talking in Yiddish. It would be I knew they were telling stories, but I had to learn Yiddish in order to begin to understand them. You've written a recent novel called The Mercy Rule, which the Washington Post says, it's, you know, as a doctor, you must know the body inside and out. And as a writer, you know the heart and the soul. So I guess it raises a question about the role of the doctor and writer. Do you see writing as reaching people in ways that you couldn't or extends the way you can in the office?
What an interesting question. I don't know that there's an easy answer to that. I certainly think, and what I'm going to say next is really about me. It's not my rule for other doctors. I think that for me, as I have worked in the medical field, part of what you have to learn, as you both know, is how to take care of people whose lives don't match your own, how to take care of families that look very different from yours, people who come out of experiences that you can't even imagine, people who live their lives based on beliefs that you don't really understand. I think for me, one of the ways that I've learn to do that is through books and writing and storytelling. I don't think it's the only way to learn that. I think I work with phenomenal physicians who have learned it in other ways, but I think for me as a writer and as a reader, the written word has had a lot to do with helping me understand the boundaries of what I've experienced directly and the ways that you cross those boundaries in order to be an effective physician.
Nice.
We've relied on Rachel Remen. I don't know if you know much about her, to help us get some things going with our medical students that get away from the science part of medicine and into the feeling part of medicine. And I think you've convinced me that what you do at NYU is got some similarities.
Oh, thank you.
As we think back and we're wrapping up, is there a final thought you would really like to leave our listeners with, many of whom are probably ready to go out and look for your list of books for Reach Out and Read and maybe come to the doctor's office and find a participating provider that has that service?
Oh, well, that would be wonderful. And, you know, any ways that you can support this work, of course, I think is important, from collecting used children's books to just letting the primary care community be part of these discussions about early education. But I guess the other thing that I would say beyond that is we have to remember when we think about children growing up with books, even in an age when there are screens and other forms of information available, there is something about a book and about a child's relationship to the book which really does open out the world to that child. And that when we find ways to help parents do that, it's so much more than the individual book. It's the language, it's the relationship with the parent, and then it's that great way out into the whole fascinating, complicated world.
Well, we need to thank you for that work. We appreciate it. Dr. Perry Klass, the medical director of Reach Out and Read, author, professor, pediatrician, humanist. Thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about someone who needs to have surgery, but they also have some complications with their liver. Laura?
My wife needs to have surgery for hip replacement, but she has liver problems associated with obesity, and she's not eligible to have a transplant. Is it safe for her to have a hip replacement?
Tough question, isn't it, Bob? This is not an easy situation.
It is a tough question, and it's tough to second-guess the surgeon who's seen her and said that she doesn't have the right history for him or her to go ahead and do that surgery. So it depends on the liver disease, I think. It depends on the extent of it. It depends upon how heavy she is. Maybe the surgeon would change his mind if she would lose some weight, and if so, how much, and maybe that's a possibility. There's a lot of ifs in this, but I think I would have to rely on the people that have actually seen her to know how to advise her.
Yeah, in this particular case, it even sounds like that the surgeon is ready to do a hip replacement, but she also has really bad liver disease, bad enough where she might qualify for a transplant, but maybe because of her age or overall health condition, she's not going to get a transplant. So the question is, if you really have a lot of medical problems, but you need a hip surgery because you can't walk, can you still have the hip surgery? I think you're right, though. I think the surgeon's going to make some decision because there's going to be risk of surgery. But in this particular case, there's going to be some risk of bleeding because with advanced liver failure, her blood counts are not the same as those who don't have liver disease. But some of that can usually be managed. It depends on how low the what's called the platelets, the blood count that needs to clot. I think that'd be one of the major considerations.
I agree.
So I think we would say is probably get an appointment with your primary care physician, and they can do some calculations, kind of like, you know, put it into that cookbook and see what comes out the other end and maybe say, you know, what your risk is. Is there a way to lower your risk? One of the drugs that sometimes lowers a risk in some surgeries is a drug called a beta blocker, Bob. It lowers that.
It does lower blood pressure a little bit, but she may not need that given her what her blood pressure runs. It's a little cardioprotective, they claim, in surgeries.
And it may even help protect against some of that the bleeding that sometimes can occur if someone has to perhaps have be intubated or something like that. So complicated situation.
Yeah, very complicated.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
My teenage son has just been diagnosed with Crohn's disease. We're a little unsettled by this diagnosis, and we are hoping that you can give us a sense of what we can expect as we get used to his new condition.
That's a very tough question to ask because Crohn's is such a variable disease. First of all, it's an anti-inflammatory disease. Second of all, it is usually existent mostly in the colon and the ileum, which is the portion of the colon just before that. It can lead to all kinds of ulcerations and even puncture of the gut, and that's a serious problem. It can involve other systems, not as commonly, can cause the eyes, kidneys, liver, and skin rashes to occur.
Yeah, I think that understanding the scope of what's happening, and I think as Bob just alluded to really nicely, it's a complicated and sometimes can be really stressful. I mean, you've got to understand the medications that can be used, and there's a whole bunch of them. You may need to talk about surgery. A lot of times that is as a way of controlling the condition. probably nutrition considerations, because you are going to have more difficulty perhaps digesting and taking certain foods for any child or adolescent with disease, even for an adult. I think it's psychiatrically, mental health, there may be real concerns. And then ultimately, there may be some increased risk of cancer of the colon, so there may be some screening as you get older. This is a complicated list.
It is a complicated list, but let's say this too. There are people that have Crohn's disease and get away with very mild episodes and don't ever have any surgical complications. And so you can't decide that because some people get the bad things that your son's going to have them.
And the good news is there's a lot more than there was 20 years ago. This disease has become, for many people, much more manageable than it was because some of the medications have improved in the understanding. And there's really excellent support groups in many communities. We would encourage our listener and their family to take advantage and to look for support groups in the community that would be very helpful.
Right.
What's our very next house call?
After I found out that I have COPD, I finally committed to quitting smoking. I've been tobacco-free for over a year now, have tried a few medications, but my doctor and I are still trying to better manage my symptoms. He suggested trying oxygen therapy. What do you think?
Well, first off, we are thrilled that you were able to quit smoking. Not something that's taken for granted, and that is one of the few things that can slow down the progression of COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
That's a good thing for him to pursue, but I don't understand the O2 therapy. What's that? I mean, this is just supplemental oxygen for his lungs is what he's talking about, or is there a new therapy for lung cancer I don't know about?
I don't think we nothing new under the sun that much, Bob. I think my take on this is that, you know, there are two things that we know for certain with COPD. One is if you quit smoking, that alters the course, and you did that. The other is if you needed oxygen therapy, being on oxygen actually can be very helpful and, again, slowing down the course. But if you don't need oxygen therapy, then oxygen therapy is not going to do anything.
Yeah, with the caveat that if you've got oxygen going in the room, you don't want to be lighting up anything, cigarettes included, because
You might say that would be an explosive condition,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
You know, we don't really know enough here. Certainly, if your oxygenation level, that oxygen saturation, which they can measure in the doctor's office, if it's above 90, certainly above 92%, oxygen's not going to benefit you. On the other hand, if you're resting in that doctor's office and it's below 88%, that oxygen is going to clearly help you. Wish you the best, and maybe ask your doctor what evidence do they have that it would benefit you. Laura, what's our very last house call?
During spring break of my senior year of college, I got a tattoo that I now, 15 years later, regret. I'd like to have it removed. Do I talk to my dermatologist about that?
Well, good news about tattoos is that there are better treatments now than there were perhaps 10 or 20 years ago. The lasers that are done in dermatologist office, I don't know of too many family doctors, Bob, that have these expensive lasers in their offices. And there's lots of different types of lasers. There's what are called Q-switched lasers. There's picosecond lasers, fractionated lasers. I know the words. I don't know fully the complexity of these. But seeing a dermatologist, because you have to not only get rid of the pigment, but you also don't want to cause really scarring. So if your skin causes lots of scarring, you have to be very, very careful.
I think that you need to sit down and be honest with yourself. And how big is this thing? How much of a problem is it really to leave it alone? Could it be incorporated in a larger one? If it's small enough, you just may just want to leave it alone.
Yeah, I think you had to understand the risk and the benefits. Hopefully, if you want to have it removed and you do get it removed, you get cosmetically the exact result you're looking for.
Exactly.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. You can share any question you have by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or visit us and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and our great guest today, Dr. Perry Klass. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.